I'm George Flynn. You're watching In Depth TV, and I've got a great friend of mine, and he's been on before, but we have had so many requests. We've got him back with us. Thank you, Dr. Santoso. Dr. Joseph Santoso is with us. He's an OBGYN with a specialty in GYN cancer.
Oncology, great.
Oncology. Dr. Santoso, we hear all about ovarian tumors and talc, and could we talk about this for just a minute about what's going on with that? And by the way, Dr. Santoso has been in practice how long here?
About 16 years.
16?
Yes.
Doesn't seem that long. That long at all. It really does. But ovarian cancer and talc, there's a lot in the media about that. Can you explain to our audience what's going on with that?
Be happy to. I think there's a lot of concern and confusions about this. And as you know, ovarian cancer is one of the deadliest cancer because it's hard to detect. So people look into how could we reduce that risk. And there's some concern that talc and asbestos may be similar in structure, and they could both causing ovarian cancer. So if you hear there are more and more people are worried that if they use talc for perennial dusting or keep themselves dry many, many years ago, if they could now at risk for ovarian cancer.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about talcum powder.
Correct.
When you, baby powder.
That's right.
And when you spray it, I just remember it was in a little container. You
Correct.
Spray it on or, Correct. You know, shake it on a baby. Are you inhaling that or is it a local thing where it's on your skin? Is there any idea of the mechanism of this?
Very good question. This whole thing started somewhere in 1970, 1980, when there were some studies start showing that you inhale and it may get into the ovarian tissue. And then there's some people who think that if you put it in the genital, the vulvar area to keep that area dry and fresh, it could migrate into the vagina, to the cervix, to the uterus, and then deposit into the ovary. And the evidence was because there were some ovarian tissue that were removed after hysterectomy, and they could find some powder. And there was another paper that put all this little study together called case control study, and they found that there's a slight elevations on the risk. So there's that concern. But when we do more study on this, that association may not be that strong. I think we have to be careful about association and causation. Association means it could be related, but causation is very strong, saying that if you do this, then you get this cancer. And that has not been proven.
You're saying it hasn't been proven, and so we should kind of watch and wait and see what has been proven as one of the etiologies or one of the causal factors of ovarian cancer.
We don't know. Majority of ovarian cancer is unknown, but about 10 to 15% are familial, in other words, hereditary. So if your mother, your sister have ovarian or breast cancer, that puts you at risk. And there's a gene especially known as BRCA1 and 2. Now we know more other gene that could also contribute to ovarian cancer, for example, like Lynch syndrome, which is usually associated with colon cancer. But now we learn that endometrial and uterine cancer and ovarian cancer are also increased in those patients with colon cancer. So if you have one cancer, you probably want to talk to your doctor, making sure that you are not susceptible to other cancer as well. Correct.
Well, could you go over, and you just got into it, I didn't mean to ask you about this, but the BRCA1 and 2, what are those? I mean, I hear about them, a lot of people hear about them. What are those genes? How do you test for them?
Very good.
And how are they related? We know they're related to breast cancer. How are they related to any other kind of GYN cancer?
BRCA1 and 2 are strongly related to breast and ovarian cancer. BRCA are tumor suppressor gene. You and I have genes that induce cell growth, almost like oncogene. So they help us to heal, help us grow, and so on. But at some point, they could be out of balance and they could grow too fast and become cancerous.
Okay.
We're blessed with a balancing act called tumor suppressor gene. Those are the gene that kind of control excessive growth of cell so they don't become cancer. Unfortunately, with BRCA1 and 2, in some patients, they mutated. That means they become defective. Therefore, those patients become more susceptible to
ovarian. So they are cancer inhibitors or correct. Tumor or growth cell growth inhibitors, both 1 and 2. And can one be defective and one be...
correct.
And either
or
one.
Or both could also be defective.
So if they... But you can start out with them as being normal.
Correct.
And then they can become defective. How do you test for these?
The test is basically a blood testing.
Okay.
We draw some blood. Usually we get you to see genetic counselor first
right.
to kind of put your risk where right. you are. Mm-hmm. And if you indeed have familial, in other words, family member with at risk, then that puts you at risk. Then we get some blood sample, we send it out, and then we get the blood test back.
Okay. And you will know.
Correct.
And if you come back with those being you're more susceptible to cancer. What do you do next?
Yeah,
because we've diagnosed and we've scared people
correct.
With it. What do we do to assure them that they are taking the best care of themselves?
Well, if they already finished their childbearing, then I would strongly recommend to remove both her ovaries and fallopian tubes.
Okay.
But if they are still young, of course, you don't want them just take their ovaries out. Then, interestingly, by just taking birth control pill for a few years, you could reduce your risk of ovarian cancer significantly. We think ovarian cancer is due to what we call incessant ovulation theory. That means when women ovulate once a month, they rupture the skin of the ovary, and during the rupture and the healing, that's damaged healing, and some gene could mutate.
Okay.
As a result. So the longer or the more frequent you have ovulations, the higher risk you are in getting ovarian cancer. So the older you are, that means you live long and then you have
right.
a lot of ovulation, that puts you at higher risk. On the other hand, if you have a medicine like oral contraceptive
right.
that suppress ovulation, then you actually reduce your risk for ovarian cancer.
So it's actually the number of ovulations
correct.
Is one of the factors.
Correct.
Are there any other factors that are, you know, like external things? People talk about diet and exercise and, you know, and I understand that a lot of that is internet stories, but what do you see? What is the science? What does it tell us?
The rest of them are not very strongly related. There are some studies suggestive of caffeine intake, cigarette, talc powders, and so on. But those relative risks are very, very weak. So in other words, if you ask me, what is the main cause of ovarian cancer? I would say 10 to 15% are hereditary. And the rest of them, we're not really sure.
Okay.
But we think it related to incessant ovulation theory.
Okay. We hear about talc being used medically.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes for a pleural effusion, they'll put in talc. What is there any study being done with or done with that?
Yes, very good question. So for the proponent who say talc is causing ovarian cancer, but actually we use talc for when you have pneumothorax, that means if your lung get injured and we try to heal that lung, we use this talc slurry. And these people usually live long, and the study had been done 15 to 40 years with observation. So after they give the talc,
right.
we watch them up to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no indication that the talc in the lung actually causing lung cancer or other cancer.
And there's some cases where you have fluid on the abdomen and you use it. Has there been any, is this same kind of results with that?
We don't really use the talc in the abdomen, but we use the talc
in the lung.
Malignant pleural effusion.
Right.
In other words, patient who developed cancer has fluid in the lung and we drain it and we put talc. Unfortunately, on the study, the observation period are very short because majority of them, most of the patients don't live that long.
Right.
So the study that really good, I think, is the pneumothorax one.
I guess what I was going to do is way back when, before you were probably born, we had gloves
uh-huh.
and they had talk on them. And so we would be doing abdominal surgery, and the glove powder would get in the abdomen. Is that very why good. We quit using that?
Part of it. There are some study that suggest that those powder actually get into the ovarian tissue.
Right.
But whether that really causing the cancer or not, we don't know. So that's the difference between association and causation.
So we don't know. But, you have cleared it up.
Yeah.
You cleared
now, this is interesting fact. I think in 1982 to 2004, the talc usage dropped from 40 million metric tons to 5,000 metric tons, just because people are scared, so they don't use it anymore.
Right.
But ovarian cancer has not decreased in that steep. So if you think about causality, then you would think there's a corresponding dose response, but that's not the case.
Not the case. Also, there are other type tumors, and we're just trying to educate you. We're not trying to make anybody afraid. There's cervical cancer. Now we hear about that, and we hear about this thing called HPV. And what is all of this about?
This is very interesting. This is one of cancer that is actually caused by virus. So human papillomavirus is a very common virus. There's about 140 types of them. 40 of them are in the anus and genital area. And they are sexually transmitted. And when you have that infection, most of us clear those up. But in certain area, when they are the aggressive type and the patient perhaps more susceptible to it, and they are not getting taken care of, then they develop cervical cancer because that virus causing it.
The HPV is correct. Still. Now, is there there's been a movement to immunize or inoculate or for HPV, what is the suggestion, the current day suggestion on that?
They are very, very effective. So if we could, I think we should vaccinate because this is one of the type of cancer that we could prevent. Now, you cannot tell people how to do sexual practice. That's not our right.
Right.
But I think by immunizations, we're not allowing our children or teenager to encourage them to have sexual relationship, but we're just wanting to have them to be prevented. It's almost like we're asking them to drive a car and we buy them in insurance.
Right.
We're not asking them to get into car accidents.
But you just want to
be safe.
Make sure.
Right.
The HPV, the vaccination, is that a shot? Or
it's a shot.
Okay. And how many times do you have to do it and how long does it last?
Well, very good question. Usually it's given 3 times, but recently there's a more newest recommendation for a younger adolescent, actually you just need 2
okay.
injection.
What ages would you say?
Start age 9.
Okay, age 9.
As early as possible.
Okay.
But most of us probably doing it 11, 12, etc. But the key is get that vaccinations before they have sexual intercourse or sexual exposure.
Right.
Again, we're not encouraging to have early sexual
right.
practice. We just want to buy them insurance. If something happened, they are protected.
So you would suggest that around between ages 9 and 13 have immunization against
you
that.
Could do it all the way up to age 26.
Okay.
That's how the insurance pay for it. Mm-hmm. Why age 26? Because the study was done up to age 26.
So you have that. And then and later on in life, do you need a booster or do we know yet?
Not at this time. So far, it seemed like it's still pretty active.
Okay.
You do not need any booster.
All right. So that is one big way to prevent cervical cancer. Are there any other factors that you know of that cause cervical cancer or can any other?
Smoking.
Smoking.
Yes, sir. It's not as causing, but it's a cofactor. We learned that when you smoke, you decrease the Langerhans cell in the cervix. And Langerhans cell more like a protective cell. So you reduce that, then people are more susceptible to cervical cancer. So it's almost like the HPV is the seed and the smoking is almost like the fertilizer.
Is still the pap smear, is that the earliest diagnosis? Or are there any symptoms or who is more susceptible or should everyone have the pap smear, all females?
I think all female that start to have sexual intercourse or at age 21 should have pap smear. And the reason is because the progression from early cancer to advanced cancer is very, very slow, which is to our advantage. So that's why the screening system using Pap smear works. Very important, I think you should seek your primary care physician, OBGYN, to get those discussion started.
And have the Pap smear.
Correct. The guideline has been moved. It used to be age 18 or earlier sexual practice, but now age 21 for everybody.
Okay. So we've got ovarian, and we've covered cervical. What about uterine cancer?
Uterine.
I mean, you know, every organ, every part of the GYN system is
correct. Uterine cancer is very fascinating. Uterine is the womb, and it is actually the most common gynecologic cancer in the United States. 52,000 American women develop this. This is a high number. And why we talk about this a little bit earlier, it's because the obesity epidemic. When you're overweight, you actually making extra hormone called estrogen. So majority of uterine cancer are hormone related. So you eat, you get overweight, and you make more hormone called estrogen. That estrogen stimulate the uterus to grow and eventually become cancer.
Okay, we hear about uterine cancers and we hear about things like that. There's something called fibroid tumors. Now, people say a tumor, fibroid, what is the difference between a fibroid tumor and a uterine cancer? And go ahead and explain that to us.
Very good question. Uterus consists of two basic component. One is what we call epithelial, and that's the endometrial layer that women shed about once a month during her menstrual period. That's the layer that most commonly become cancer in overweight patient. The fibroid is the muscle. And you know, when the woman deliver a baby, you need that muscle to push the baby out. And that's the big part of the uterus. And many of them develop benign tumor called fibroid. So they grow, but they don't become invasive. It doesn't spread. It doesn't kill people in general.
Right.
Now, they could become very big and become symptomatic. We call them fibroid. Unfortunately, some part of that muscle that also look like fibroid also could become sarcoma, leiomyosarcoma, and that kill people. And unfortunately, it's difficult radiographically. Now, you're the expert on this one. You probably could tell me more how to do this. But to my best understanding, it's very difficult to differentiate between fibroid or sarcoma. But if the patient get follow-up regularly, then your physician will become more alert if the fibroid suddenly growing faster than what it's supposed to be. Then this index of suspicion for cancer will be elevated.
And you can say, surely we've talked about all of GYN cancers, but there's one other one. There's what's called a molar pregnancy. Now, that's when a pregnancy can turn into a tumor. And have you seen many of these, or are these common or uncommon?
It's not that common, but because this is my practice, I do see them regularly. And what's fascinating about this is it's a placental tumor. So when a woman pregnant and there's a placenta, and that tissue, the one that become cancer, majority of them self-limited, but some of them become persistent and become very, very aggressive.
And right, so you can find those that are, like you say, self-limited and go ahead and have another pregnancy and just keep close eye on it?
Please be very, very careful. That's because once you have a molar pregnancy, you increase your risk for the next pregnancy to become molar as well.
That's why we need to really follow those people that have had a molar pregnancy. And it's not all surgery. Sometimes they treat it with medications, and you do treat these. Do you follow them up?
Correct. So when you have this abnormal pregnancy, the placental become tumor, we call it molar pregnancy, and most of the time you do not have any baby in there, fortunately. Yeah. So that's make it things simpler in the sense. Then your doctor would do a DNC, or what we call dilatation evacuation, but it's more like a DNC, basically scraping and evacuating those placental tumor. After that, usually we just watch your beta HCG or pregnancy tests, but we quantify it. And again, majority will resolve on their own, but certain part will become persistent. That level keep on going up or steadily stay the same. In that situation, then we need to make sure that this is not a malignant choriocarcinoma, which is very aggressive, or some other type. And for majority of the types, we could use just single agent chemotherapy. But for the choriocarcinoma, we have to use multiple chemotherapy, which is very toxic.
Right. And your part of this is the surgery.
Correct. And also the chemotherapy.
That's what I was getting to.
Correct.
You do the surgery, and then you are able to follow up. Correct. And administer chemotherapy.
I think being a GYN oncologist, what I like is I feel like I'm a family practice for women taking care of their cancer. So I do their surgery, I could give their chemotherapy, I assist with radiations. So to me, it's a more wholesome type of practice, and I feel that I could help my patient better.
Now, in radiation, most people think of a big machine and a beam of radioactivity going onto a tumor. Are there internal seeds or internal things like that? Do you do those?
Correct. Actually, for cervical cancer, the most common practice now for advanced cervical cancer is chemotherapy and radiation. So for the first 5 weeks, they will get external beam radiation. It's almost like getting X-ray.
Right.
Once a day for about 5 weeks. And then they follow with the radiation inside into the cervix, and that's called tandem and avoid, or okay, brachytherapy. Brachy right. means close
right.
therapy. And so I would place those equipment, and then our radiation oncologist partner will insert, using robot, to insert the iridium, which is the type of radiation source.
Well, back years ago, I used to be the robot. I was the one inserting the radioactive seeds.
We tried to minimize the radiation exposure. Now we use robot to do that.
Yeah, the best one is when you were sitting there trying to read the serial number on the thing right here and then putting the seeds in. That happened.
Correct.
But we would put those in and then leave them a wow. certain amount of time. And
that's correct.
And bring them out. So we've got radiation therapy, we got surgery, we have chemotherapy. Is there any place of immunotherapy in GYN cancer? I hear about it in other tumors, but
it has. It used to be the most exciting thing, and then it's kind of like lost popularity with the advancement of chemotherapy, but it's now rising up again. For example, in melanoma, we learned that immunotherapy is much more effective than chemotherapy. So for certain cancer, I think immunotherapy is gaining upward. We haven't really seen that effectiveness in cancer with women. So we need to do more study on this.
And now, do you limit yourself as far as ovaries, uterus, fallopian tubes, or cervix? Do you deal with cancers of the breast?
Very good question. As GYN oncologist, basically, I take care of below the belt.
Okay.
So I leave the breast cancer to the breast surgeon and medical oncologist.
Okay. So we just wanted to define, because most people hear GYN oncologist and they say, well, what is that? And what kind of training did you have to be able to do this?
First, we have to finish medical school, and then we go on with OBGYN residency. After that, then we do additional.
Where did you do all of this?
Oh, California, University of California.
So Davis. You went to medical school at UC Davis.
Correct.
And then did you have to do an internship?
Or yes.
Then where did you do all of this?
Internship and residency at UC Davis.
Okay.
And then after that, I get fascinated with surgical critical care and trauma. So I did critical care fellowship at UC Davis. And then I fell in love again with GYN onc, so I went to UT Southwestern to do my GYN oncology fellowship.
So you confused me there. So you did your residency in OBGYN.
Correct.
And then you did what? What is it?
Critical care.
Critical care.
Surgical critical care fellowship.
Okay. And then you did another fellowship.
Correct.
How many years of training do you have?
Quite a few years.
We need to add those up sometime. You'd be amazed. Okay. And then, so here you come out of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And you're, you know, GYN oncologist. How did we get you? How were we lucky enough to get you here in Memphis, Tennessee?
I think I'm lucky enough to come to Memphis. Dr. Ling was the chairman at University of Tennessee, OBGYN, who recruited me here.
So, did you know Frank Ling from
A
something?
little
Or
bit
you
because he
did?
was the president of American Board. So everybody knows Dr. Ling, but he didn't know who I am. Then we talk and we learn that we have a lot of commonalities, and that's why I came here.
And you came here, and you have you been? Where did you start practice?
I start practice with UT and with Boston Baskin Cancer Group
Okay, and
for a few years, and then I joined West
West
Clinic.
Clinic, and so you're in practice. You live here. You do you still go to a lot of meetings, or do you probably speaking now a lot? But tell us a little bit about it. When you give talks, what do you usually talk about?
I give talk what fascinate me. I think I'm at my stage in my career that I really could do what I like to do. And I think life is short and we have to really concentrate on what we like. And when we do that, I think we also excel because
What
it's our passion.
do you like, and not necessarily always in medicine, but what do you like as far as hobbies go? And probably your hobby's working, but do you have other interests?
I do. I like to repair things at home. So I learned I'm an amateur handyman.
Like
So
toasters or what, like
anything that I could tinker with. So leaky roof, leaky plumbing system. Again, I'm not an expert, but the YouTube helped me to learn all those things. So you won't be surprised to see me walking around at Home Depot or Lowe on the weekend.
And I think I've seen you there, but surely you wear gloves. What do you do to protect yourself? Because you've got to go to work Monday, and
Correct.
a weekend repairman. How do you just look at the risk versus the benefit?
Correct. And also the enjoyment. It's fun to fix things.
It is.
And I like doing that.
Well, you fix things on the weekend. You fix people during the week.
I try.
I think that's a great idea. Do you enjoy other things? Do you have a family here? Or?
I do. I'm married. And I have a wife. We don't have children, but we like babysitting other people's children. So
Well, wait a
we have
minute.
fun.
Don't say that much, because people will be calling you a lot. So that's fantastic. And your wife is from around here, or
From Houston,
she's from
and she
Houston?
works for St. Jude
Okay, so you met her in Houston.
in Houston.
Okay, so you got a lot of training in Texas, didn't you?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you coming on with us and explaining. Your first show, we explained about the over what being overweight and being the different factors about cancer, but you really delved into GYN cancer. Is there anything you could tell people in the last minute or two here? What would they do to avoid the cancers and avoid seeing you except in Lowe's or Home Depot?
Thank you. I think number one is quit smoking. Smoking is just bad for the heart, the lung, the cancer, everything else. So if you smoke, please quit. Not to mention you save money too.
Right.
It's what, $4 per pack or $5 per
A
pack.
lot.
Secondly, I think you should maintain ideal body weight. You don't have to be skinny. You don't have to be very thin like those magazines. But excessive weight is not good for you. It's not good for the heart, not good for diabetes, not good for the cancer,
Right.
like we talked before. Get some exercise. If you can't exercise, then just put activity in your life. Park your car further away. Take stair instead of elevator. Things like that actually probably will do you much good for your future.
And let me tell you, I've tried to walk with him in the hospital, and he walks so fast. So I just looked at his leg. I said, "Can they be longer? Something's going on there." Thank you very much for being
Thank you.
here, and I really appreciate it, Dr. Joseph Santoso. And we look forward to seeing you next time on George Flynn. You've been watching In-Depth TV. See you next time.